order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart and take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart and take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. Whatever the virtues of the many fields of knowledge, all our steps on the paths of omniscience, may these arise in the clear mirror of intellect. O Manjushri, please accomplish this.
So tonight we begin another course on meditation, the core, the foundation of the path. We're good. We're recording. Thank you for asking. And the general scheme is once a year, each fall, we do a course on meditation, and then we launch off into the other topics of the Shedra curriculums. And our backup. And over the years, so this, by the way, we're starting our 15th year. For those of you.
That's right.
That, I think Peter and I go back.
It was 14, now it's 15.
Yeah, yeah, the fall of 18 is the start of the 15th year. And we've done many, many courses on meditation. We've done surveys of Theravada Buddhist meditation, Indian Vipassana meditation, Tibetan Vipassana meditation, Trungpa Rinpoche's meditation scheme, a few of those. And over that period of time, I've been like collecting all the core texts on meditation, tons of them, as some people have helped me collect them and create them and make them into nice versions that you can read to in a clean way. And so I thought, let's look at the most important core texts of the for Shamatha Vipassana, our basic practice, that's the basis of all other practices in our tradition that we inherit. And so we look at basically the table of contents is a little jam-packed, but just to pick out really the highlights of them are these it's really four key texts. The first one is number 5 in the table of contents, the Maitreya chapter, the questions of Maitreya, Bodhisattva, to the Buddha. There's this wonderful Q&A that Maitreya has with the Buddha in a sutra called the Samdhinirmochana Sutra, which in English is variously translated as untying the knots, meaning resolving the difficulties, the knots of things that are difficult to understand in the Dharma, revealing the also translated sometimes as revealing the true intention of the Buddha's teachings, sutra. And it's a core sutra for the third turning teachings. It goes through the concept of there being three turnings, and it also goes through the three natures, and talks a little bit about mind only, but not that much. But an amazing Q&A with Maitreya and the Buddha, where he basically like asks all the questions of the Buddha that you might want to ask, maybe not all of them, because his questions are a little bit on a sort of level that's like way over my head. But it raises the bar. Like, this is, you know, we have the Satipatthana Sutta for the Theravada tradition, the early tradition of the teachings of the Buddha, that's handed down from theoretically those who were there to hear it. And we've looked at that a number of times. I think everyone has been in a class where we've gone through that, the Four Foundations of Mindfulness Sutra. And then when we look at the Mahayana tradition, the sutra source for Shamatha Vipassana, for meditation practice, is this chapter by far. There's no other place. people talk about the Samadhi Raja Sutra. Samadhi Raja Sutra is an oddly named sutra, the King of Samadhi Sutra, in that it doesn't talk a lot about the details of meditation practice.
What's the Four Foundations one?
The Satipatthana Sutra. And so the Samdhinamochana Sutra comes out, appears on the scene somewhere like in the 3rd to 4th century of the Common Era, just to place it chronologically, some 7 or so hundred years after the life of the Buddha, after theoretically he spoke the Satipatthana Sutta. And this sutra appears, attributed to the Buddha. And during that time, we see over that period of time, there's some sort of development, transformation that goes on, where in the early sutras attributed to the Buddha by the earliest strata of Buddhist literature, very little mention of shamatha vipassana. It's there. It's a couple of little snippet sutras, very short, like a few paragraphs, literally, that are about shamatha vipassana. And the main emphasis is on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. He teaches that three times. There's three versions of that sutra. There's another sutra that's related to it called the Anapanasati Sutta. That's the contemplation of the placement of attention on the breath sutra.
Isn't that the same stuff, though? On attention and mindfulness, isn't that meditation?
Yes.
I'm
not understanding. I'm referring to those as the earlier version of meditation sutra.
Right. Okay. But shamatha didn't come along as a word.
Well, it's in there, but it's not.
They use shamatha.
Yes. So I'm agreeing with you, and you're cutting to the chase. And what in the early tradition, meditation is all around those foundations of mindfulness, placing mindfulness on those four realms. In those three sutras about called the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, and in the Mindfulness of Breathing Sutra, it's exclusively on the breath. And then, so over that 500, 600, 700 years, somehow there's an evolution that occurs where the focus turns towards shamatha and vipassana as being the core way of talking about understanding and practicing meditation that incorporates then the Four Foundations of Mindfulness within it as a main technique of shamatha and vipassana. But the larger scheme becomes shamatha and vipassana. And so we see shamatha and vipassana being talked about by Maitreya and Asanga. Maitreya and his famous 5 books. Hey, come on in. Hi, come on in. Hi, welcome. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi.
Hi, Cynthia.
Hi.
Hi, Neil. Wow, all three at once.
We were locked out.
Oh, downstairs?
No, upstairs. We've been banging for a while.
Sorry.
We finally woke up the other group and we tried texting.
There's nobody at the desk.
Calling.
Sorry.
No way.
You all have your phones off. We tried calling.
Yeah.
We were talking about you.
Well. It was all nice.
So hard copy source books, $15 whenever you have it, please. Do you want to take one for Lindsay? I think you're an electrical digital, or you want a hard copy tonight? Yeah, there's extra.
Are you all three, right?
Yeah.
So 3 books?
Just 2. Neil's just going to, I think, just use for tonight.
Yes. We're
just
So where was I?
The transition to shamatha vipassana from mindfulness in the old tradition to the new tradition.
Yeah. So around the same time as this sutra, the Samdhinamochana.
I'm sorry.
It's probably Cynthia calling
you.
Open up.
He also sent an email to everybody who responded.
Sorry about that.
So who knows? Somebody might be.
You don't want to change it off.
We could just stay here all night right now.
We're on our own.
slumber party.
Take all that food and... around the same time as that sutra. Sorry,
I just wanted to follow up on
Peter's
question. Isn't shamatha mindfulness?
Great question, but we'll come back to it.
I guess we're going to get there.
But I'll try to get there.
Okay.
But basically, shamatha means calm abiding, even placement, literally. Atta is to place something, and shama is evenly, like an even surface, or on a continuous, in a continuous basis, placing continuously and evenly. And mindfulness is a different term in Sanskrit, in Pali, and so forth. Smriti in Sanskrit, sati in Pali. So in Pali, you have the Satipatthana Sutra. It's the four establishments of mindfulness, sati. And then you have samatha, is the Pali. Different words, different meanings. And the relationship between them in the early tradition is unclear. The relationship over time evolves and is used differently in different places. And today, the relationship remains unclear. Part of the hope of and the objective of this course is to see if we can collectively come to some clarity around the relationship between those terms. And even more confusing, vipassana, and what is that, and how does that relate to the scheme?
I've heard that in the early, I haven't read all the early sutras, so I find them the most interesting things to go through, that it was not referred to as something different, shamatha and vipassana. It was just people went and did shamatha vipassana. It was like a practice of combined, steadying the mind, and then going through sort of the meditation.
Can you show me where you've read that?
No, I can't. I've heard it through like the teachers in the Boulder, Colorado sort of area who are Indo-Tibetan and
because
jump and deep dive into
as
it.
As far as I know, that's a projection of the later Indo-Tibetan tradition, because that's how it becomes to be used. And in the early tradition, they're very much different. And in the earliest tradition also, there's a reference where the Buddha says there's two ways of progressing on the path. You can practice shamatha, and then upon that basis, practice vipassana. Or you can practice vipassana and basically achieve liberation through vipassana without establishing shamatha, and go through the full path of shamatha, which includes the absorption state.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the earlier tradition is very much different from what we receive. We receive this version of 2,500 years of amalgamation and synthesis that says, you know, you just practice the two together.
But in that sutra, I believe, I've heard, I don't remember which and where at this point, going through the, let's say, three or four depending on stages of samadhi, would that not be the progression of shamatha? And you don't need that to begin vipassana, but it's encouraged as you were saying. There's the stages of, like, if you practice the meditative absorptions, that's one path, and then you can also go through the sort of contemplative approach, and that leads to that. But they kind of intersect. They end up as if they're intertwined. You can't necessarily, you can start here, but you end up there, you can start here and end up there. At least that's how I came to understand that passage that you're referring to.
There's many different opinions on it. Many different opinions on it. So, you know, the purpose of this is let's read the source text and see what they say, see what these ones say. We don't have the Satipatthana Sutta and the early stuff that we're referring to, though. Here we couldn't do everything I figured. So number five, the Maitreya chapter of the Samdhinirmochana Sutra, around the 3rd, 4th century. And then we have the Bhavanakrams, the famous presentation that Kamala Shila gives to the Tibetan world when Buddhism is brought into Tibet by his teacher, Shantarakshita. along with Padmasambhava and Vimalamitra and Vairochana in the 8th century. And he writes this text called Bhavanakrama that has three identical Bhavanakramas, and they're just given the titles Bhavanakrama 1, 2, and 3. And a lot of the material is overlapping, but they're referred to as being the major source for the tradition of meditation in, throughout the entire history of Tibet. So we see texts by Jamgon Kongshol referring endlessly to the Bhavanakramas, and other teachers endlessly of all traditions of Tibetan Buddhism referring to the Bhavanakramas as the sort of authoritative source. And so there's no yet version of the three of them in print. There's a number of versions of the second Bhavanakrama in print, and I use what I believe to be the best of those second ones, the second one, and then there's a gentleman in Australia did a dissertation where he did all three, he translated, and picked up one and three from his versions and combined it with the second one that's translated in a published version, because I believe that version is better. So it's different translators for one.
So
for two.
You mean English? I mean, it has to be lost in the...
No. Yeah, in print in English. In actual publication. Whereas a dissertation is sort of printed on paper, but it's not published in the way that we say in print.
So you're saying only the second one is actually printed?
Is actually published.
Published. And the other,
in a book.
The one and three are only available
in a dissertation, yeah. There is actually a version published in India by an Indian scholar where it has all three together, and it's just not a good translation. It's not worth looking at. So I dismissed that one. I apologize. So that's the second major.
It's so authoritative and yet hasn't been focused on for translation.
It is amazing, isn't it? It's unfortunate. Yeah, it's really unfortunate. And we'll come when we go over there, we can talk a little bit about that. There's a little bit of a story behind that. Let's see. And then we have, thirdly, we have the main text on meditation in our tradition by, our tradition meaning Kagyu, primarily Kagyu, but Kagyu Nyingma, of the Rime tradition, of the Jamgon Kongchul sort of era, and his famous text on Shamatan Vipassana that's in the Treasury of Knowledge, Book 8, Part 2, which we've looked at. I think we've all seen that a number of times, and I just have the root verses here as opposed to the full text. Since the full text is about 30 pages, I just picked up a few. So we get to see the essentials of that. And so that's the third major text. And then the fourth major text is, let's see how the practice of shamatha vipassana are then transformed in the Mahamudra tradition, in the Vajrayana completion stage practice traditions. There's two of those that use shamatha vipassana. There's Mahamudra and there's Dzogchen traditions. And the Mahamudra tradition is much clearer in its utilization of the system of Mahamudra, of shamatha vipassana. It really makes a really interesting and powerful advance upon the way shamatha and vipassana are structured, looked at as a progression, and practiced. And there's different types of Mahamudra, and there's certainly the type that can be studied and practiced with benefit by anybody, as opposed to some types of Mahamudra will require a teacher who actually understands the material, unlike myself, and transmissions. But together maybe we can gain something from it, I think. So those are the four main texts. And then I've added in some auxiliary material to help us go through these. In the beginning for tonight, I'm going to try to go through items 1, 2, 3, and 4, which are general material about shamatha. I would like us to sort of get on the same page with the shamatha that we receive at this point. So I'm starting with today's sort of version of shamatha, and then we're going to go back almost 2,000 years to the Sampinara Mochana Sutra. And then I have some commentary on Jamgon Kongtrul's text, and actually the Kamala Shila's Bhavana Krama by Trungpa Rinpoche in his wonderful book called The Practice of Tranquility, and inside a couple of excerpts from that, where it's actually titled The Commentary on the Bhavana Kramas, but it also Treasury of Knowledge. And then excerpts from The Royal Seal of Mahamudra by Kamtro Rinpoche, which came out in the last year or two. It's a really wonderful book on Mahamudra. It's great, very helpful information on Shamatha Vipassana. Really from even just like from what we call a Sutrayana point of view, which is why I put it before we go through the other Mahamudra texts, because it really helps flesh out the understanding of the nuances of the different aspects of Shamatha Vipassana. Getting back to Anya's question of like, well, what is mindfulness and how does that differ from Shamatha?
He's a currently living Rinpoche?
He is not a currently living Rinpoche. He's passed away in the third Kamtrul Rinpoche. We're now at the fourth Kamtrul Rinpoche.
But he's of the modern era.
He's of the modern era, right. It was written maybe 100 years ago or so, something like that. Or within the last 150 years, something like that, I believe. And we have some excerpts from the works of a really wonderful, unusual teacher named Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, who taught extensively on Shamatha Vipassana, brought together a lot of different streams and nuances in the way that he presented it. And then lastly, I added at the very last page, because it was an odd number of pages, so instead of having a blank page, I just put this very short text by Atisha on how to practice Vipassana that maybe will be helpful. So let's look at, for starters, on the next page you have the syllabus. So those two are not identical, right? Mm-hmm. And then on page number 5, have this famous chart of the various aspects of Shamatha. It's titled The Nine Stages. I forgot to change the title because it's way more than the nine stages, as you see. The nine stages is the first call. So I think many of us, if not most of us, have seen this before, and the nine stages becomes or is presented in a way that quickly becomes unachievable and unrelatable, I think, to most of us, or at least I'll speak to myself, for myself, something that I'm not experiencing in my practice. And so the nine stages becomes a little bit odd thing to look at. But what I find really helpful is the various qualities that are provided as ways of progressing through the practice of Shamatha Vipassana. The most common one that we all know about, the most common scheme, is the obstacles and the antidotes. But I want to focus on a scheme that I personally find very helpful, which is called the Six Powers. So it's the second to last. The idea is that through different aspects, the six powers presents the main mental faculties that one cultivates in Shamatha practice in a progressive manner, in a naturally progressive manner is the idea, and that these mental faculties really are what give you the ability to develop and use antidotes to overcome obstacles and thereby progress through the nine stages.
Hearing is a mental faculty? Hearing?
hearing, the first two are not generally included in the mental faculties. You're right. The ones after that are. Mental faculties is a technical term referring to like the 51 mental factors. Here, maybe the six powers are mental activities activities of the mind. So starting with hearing or learning about the practice. In the first stages of the practice, I think all of us go through this period where we're just learning the technique, we're learning why do we meditate, what am I doing, what is the purpose of it, what am I hoping to get out of it. And we're learning a little bit about ourselves. We're learning about the speediness of our mind. We're learning about difficulty of sitting physically still. And we're learning about the teachings of Buddhism generally at the same time, to some extent or another. We're learning about the scheme of attitude, emotional attitude, and the view that goes along with the practice of meditation, whether that's presented in detail or briefly. And I personally think that when we present meditation to new individuals that are new, rather, to the practice, we don't have enough appreciation of this phase of them learning the technique and taking it slowly through what are the different aspects of it and why we do them, what are their functions, how to, in particular, the nuances of the posture and the breath are, I think, extremely subtle, and we gloss through them very quickly. We go through the seven points of posture, but we don't really help people that much with them, and we expect people to be able to connect to their breath right away, which is not really, doesn't really happen. I find that it takes quite a while for people to genuinely connect to the breath. And what Anya referenced before is, what are the different aspects of mind? What are these other mental, in this case, from four, two onward, those four other powers are actually mental faculties. What are those? And what are their different functions in the practice of meditation? So then contemplating that phase is about bringing what one's learning into one's continuum, into one's mind and body, and into one's life, and sort of gradually organizing one's life so that one has a priority for meditation practice, you find a place to meditate, you develop a situation that's conducive to meditation, you begin to understand experientially as opposed to terminologically, you begin to understand the different aspects of the practice, the different aspects of the posture and the breath and the aspects of mind that are involved in the practice. And so these are said to then be coupled along with the first three of the eight antidotes: faith, gaining confidence in the practice, having some notion both that wakefulness is possible, and that meditation is worth doing, therefore, and that meditation can be efficacious. Meditation can actually be helpful in dealing with whatever one comes to the practice for. And a lot of what we deal with in the first stages of meditation practice is working with our expectation. We come to the practice with some expectation of maybe relief from psychological anguish or some experience of reality or enlightenment. I have a naive notion that that's going to dawn somehow very quickly. Some sense of gaining a confidence that the slow and gradual path of meditation is actually worth pursuing, and is powerful and valuable. And through that, building up an aspiration to continue the practice, to continue understanding the subtleties of the practice, to continue to do the practice, and to continue to open, to honestly experience what happens, what opens up in the, as we practice meditation, and begin to explore our inner realm, and begin to see all of our habitual patterns and our neurosis and the memories and the emotions that we store within our body and mind that we've been keeping there. Effort, bringing faith and aspiration together, and developing a sense of understanding that in order to experience anything in meditation practice, both we're going to have to exert effort to get to the practice, and then when we're on the cushion, we're actually going to have to actually apply ourselves. It's not going to just like happen to us. We actually have to come to bring our energy together and try to work with our wild mind, our mind that is either racing around or falling asleep. Those two alternatives generally happen in the beginning phase. And through that process, we develop the first inkling of this thing called suppleness or pliancy, which appears a number of times in the path, and is actually, when it's full-blown, it represents the culmination of shamatha. When it's full-blown, it represents the culmination of vipassana. And without full-blown pliancy or suppleness, one does not accomplish or complete or perfect shamatha or vipassana. But some sense of suppleness that you begin to have naturalness around the technique, it begins to become familiar. You don't have to struggle to remember what you're doing. And there's sort of a synchronization. The way Rinpoche, Trungpa Rinpoche translates it as synchronization of mind and body. You're beginning to like be in your body when you're sitting and meditating, as opposed to being all over the place. Your mind actually sort of comes into your body. So like instead of but most of the time during the day, we sort of project our energy out through our eyes or through engagement with our world, and we're sort of scattered all over the place. Gradually, over time, bringing our energy together so that when we're on the cushion practicing, we actually feel like we're here. It's a little bit different than our normal state of mind. And those together overcome the first two of the obstacles of laziness, which has a broader range of meanings than just sort of sluggishness than we think of, but also includes preoccupation, excessive preoccupation or busyness, and forgetting the instructions, just sitting there and spacing out and not actually applying the meditation practice. When we sit down on the cushion, the gong rings at the beginning and then it rings at the end. It's like, what happened in between? And so those are overcome by those first four antidotes, which are cultivated through those first two powers. And that brings us to the mental faculty of mindfulness. So mindfulness in... a little glossary for us, but I don't, unfortunately.
Does that mean that basically the three prajnas, the first two are encompassed here, and all the rest is sort of meditating?
That's a really good question, right? Cynthia's pointing out that those two first, the first two powers, hearing, contemplating, are identical to the first two types of prajna, right? But it's a type of prajna that occurs here, but it's applied to a different set of topics. In this case, it's hearing and contemplating about the practice of shamatha, whereas in the development of prajna, we talk, or actually in the practice of vipassana, we talk about developing prajna in term using the object of the true nature of reality. Three marks or four marks, the possibility of truly inherent existence. So in that case, there's a separate set of hearing and contemplating that would occur in Vipassana practice.
So it's generally three prashnas considered to be defined as relating only to Vipassana, because that's truly wisdom. Or is it
would be like higher prajna, you know, and they come up with lower and higher prajna.
So these are still considered
a type of prajna.
Hearing and contemplating in the context of prajna.
Yes, it's very much, you know, so actually when you talk about faculties of mind, this would be part of the mental factor of prajna.
Okay, and then, because then I was wondering if then all the rest of them in the rest of the six, you know, column there
are meditating.
Are in the realm of meditating, because basically the first one is sort of like getting ready to or
that's a good point, thank you.
And then all the rest, that's what I was really thinking of, is that it sort of frames those three, although it's not in the chart, but it could be viewed as.
Yeah, the remaining four could be viewed as meditation, as the prajna of meditation. Of the six, right?
What's that? I just meant that within, the other four.
The other four.
Sorry, the other four. I'm seeing three. That's four, right? Sorry. I'm looking at boxes.
Yeah, that's good. Thank you. That's great.
Yeah.
That's neat.
Because all the rest are really doing it.
Yeah. Neil.
And is there a reason why in the columns of three levels, the three qualities, the middle stage and the last stage overlap? In the sense that you're going that stage is 4 to 7 for meditation at three levels, that's 7 to 9, and then 4 to 5, and then 5 to 9. Whereas the other ones go very much, there's no overlap.
Let's see, so you're looking at the columns called three levels, three qualities, six powers, and experience.
And so they're just three levels and three qualities, and in three levels, your actual meditation is stages 4 to 7, but your increasing meditation is stages 7 to 9. You overlap on stage 7.
Oh, I see.
And the same, you overlap on stage 5 in the three qualities.
Oh, I see. Or was that just a...
Was yours a typo or for why?
No, that's the way they present it, right. Traditionally.
That also
maybe occurs. There is an overlap there between, you know, whereas the others are more...
They could decide.
Yeah, I think the part of it is they try to show that like actual meditation spans both vividness and strength, and strength spans both.
Okay, so that would make sense.
Introspection as well as, you know, applying things like that.
Okay.
They're trying to show that. You know, it's not segmented completely, but there is overlap. It's actually on page 17. No, sorry, 19. There's a chart with terms with all the different languages, fortunately. Here we have mindfulness is the English. Now, we don't use the term awareness as being the same as mindfulness. This is from an article on Wikipedia, on Sati. So, you know, I should have made our own version of this, but meaning in the tradition of what Trungpa Rinpoche, how he presented meditation faculties, we view awareness as separate from mindfulness. And almost everyone does. This one is sort of coming from the sort of Theravada point of view of the practice, where they just mush, you know, their version of Vipassana is like all has shamatha Vipassana together in it. They're basically sort of confusing. Anyway, English. If you look at the Pali, sati is mindfulness. In Sanskrit, smriti, the R with a dot under is pronounced as if there's an I after the R, so smriti. I can't pronounce the Chinese, but I'm gonna skip that. And then there's Tibetan, trenpa. Right, so it'd be good if we were familiar with a few of these basic terms, that one in particular, and the next one, starting with the Pali. Sampajana, prajanya, pretty much the same in Sanskrit. Sampajanya. Sampajanya. Clear comprehension is
one
translation of it. Correct cognition has too much of like a slant towards epistemological level.
So what is
we usually say awareness for this.
I knew it, yeah.
Right?
this is what we would call... Translate to awareness?
Well, we have a little problem because yes. Trungpa Rinpoche uses awareness for Vipassana, right? And the way... And we'll come back to this. We saw it in the Mixing Mind with Space class, where the way that he uses Vipassana is basically he's talking about Sampajanya. Half of the time he talks about Vipassana as being that which sees egolessness, which is the traditional way of talking about Vipassana. That's not awareness.
Sees the ego?
Sees egolessness.
Sees egolessness.
Understands egolessness.
So that's Prajna.
Right. The other part of the time, Rinpoche talks about Vipassana as being panoramic awareness. And there he's really talking about Sampajanya. And one of the great things in the Royal Seal of Mahamudras, there's a little section where he talks about how the Mahamudra tradition brings those two things together, brings Sampajanya, links it up with Vipassana as being the foundation for the development of Vipassana. And you can see in the root of the word, prajna is there. So it's a cognate or form of prajna, and it's very much a launching pad for the development of prajna, which is why I believe Trungpa Rinpoche used it as Vipassana, because it does provide the basis for then exploring egolessness or exploring the sense of self to the point of not finding. Anyway, these two are the main two qualities. When we talk about shamatha primarily has these two qualities unanimously: mindfulness and sampajanya. Sampajanya more commonly translated as introspection or vigilance. Vigilance is a little bit hyper for most translators. For most people, it has too much a sense of like paranoia. Introspection is a more common translation for sampajanya. Cynthia?
So just the
sam,
what does the
sam
mean in front of the
question? Sam is a particle in Sanskrit that Sanskrit particles are tricky. Sometimes they have zero meaning, and sometimes they have huge meaning, and sometimes they have somewhere in between. In Tibet, they translated every particle as if it had meaning, and sometimes they conflate things by doing that without really needing to. But some generally, just like in samatha, some means conjoined with. So being with understanding. The Tibetan is she jin, which means very knowing. She is the shepa from knowing or knowledge or mind, the main term for mind, shepa. And jin is a hyperlative, whatever, very much.
A superlative.
So those two terms. And then we have a couple of other, the next two terms that are less common, but still do appear. Starting with the Tibetan, Pak Yu. Anyone remember that from Trungpa Rinpoche's teachings?
Yeah.
In the transcripts and in the Profound Treasury, Volume 1. Pak Yu, the residue of mindfulness, he calls it. He calls it, he uses the analogy of a lichen. or fungus. It's like that mindfulness leaves this continuity, this residue in your being that then carries over into your entire life, where you have a sort of stability continuity of presence, continuity of mindfulness and awareness, really. It's really that sense of steadfastness in the application of mindfulness and awareness, the other two qualities, or introspection. In Sanskrit, apramada. In Pali, apramada.
Is it like the strength that you get from doing those?
It definitely seems like that is the strength that one gets from it.
Right? Vigilance is beyond awareness. It's much more intense.
Yeah, and it's like the ability to be constantly present, constantly on your guard. And that has a sense of paranoia, but if you can like have that quality of being on guard without it, paranoia, just, you know, very, very watchful, continuously watchful, always seeing what's going on. And then the fourth one, starting with the English, ardency. Anyone recognize where that term famously appears?
Oh, the is that in the four foundations?
Yes.
Yeah. Ardently so, does this and that.
Yeah, so in the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha goes through the four foundations of mindfulness, body, feeling, mind, and dharmas. And within each one he goes through a number of different divisions. The breath, the postures of the body, the parts of the body, the types of feeling, the different states of mind, the different dharmas, the seven factors of enlightenment, the five skandhas, you know, blah, blah, blah. For each one, the refrain is, thus a monk contemplates, ardent, clearly comprehending, and mindful. And so for him, clearly, those three are a triad of factors that together constitute the meditative experience, or the meditative capability. Ardent, mindful, clearly comprehending. And so this is the root of that term ardent, atapa. Now the Tibetan, I checked with Alan Moss recently, and he said that's meaningless, it's just absurd. Nima always means day, there's no other meaning for Nima in the Tibetan dictionary. So day, sun, Ni is sun.
So this isn't right.
So this part, he claims, is not right.
Who was that? Yeah.
Alan Watts, B. Alan Watts.
Oh, uh-huh.
I ran into him right over there. I'm not going to go through the other two, because, okay.
So wait, just one thing you said, from the Four Foundations Sutra, those three then, would that be Sati, Apamada, Sati, Sampajana, and Atapa?
That's correct, yes. Mindful, clearly comprehending, mindful, sati, clearly comprehending, sampajanya, and ardent, atapa. So those three factors. Now, why don't we see those three factors like repeated everywhere? I don't know. We see the two factors repeated everywhere in the tradition that we inherit.
Funny, because by saying Nima there, I thought it was like, I just got this great insight about the Shambhala teachings and like something they'd never addressed. And you know,
it's the ML makes sense.
But for them, they use that image, just the typo.
So somebody should just go in and correct that? I mean, this is what you're
I should work on finding out.
Yeah.
Correct. And then he gives attention, Manasikara. Manasikara. As a big factor.
Focus is that?
Attention is usually considered to be one of the aspects of trenpa, mindfulness, sati, in the Mahayana tradition. And then foundation of mindfulness is satipatthana. Just so you see what that is. Neil.
So what would this say to me for...
I don't know, I'm going to work on that.
So you said this attention is part of trenpa?
Yeah, it is one of three aspects of sati.
I know you described clear comprehension. You spent a good amount of time describing the root word of that, and it reminds me of, like, is it jhana or dhyana, but it looks like that, but it's not that word here? Or is it related to that? You know how there's samadhi?
It's related
jhana.
To jhana.
Yeah,
But not, jhana is the Pali for dhyana.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a different verbal root. This comes from the verbal root jnya. J-N-Y-A. And with a little
wave
on top. So jnya, that's the root of jnana, prajna, samprajna. Dhyana and in Pali, jhana are different root. D-H-Y.
They're related to clear comprehension. They're in the same sort of space of...
No, dhyana and jhana are not. They're absorption states. They're focused, intently focused states. They don't have
samadhi.
Samadhi yet is another term as well, yeah. Well, samadhi is a vague term. It's like dhyana is a very broad term. Samadhi is a very broad term. And they're used differently in different traditions. And so you'd have to sort of decide which version you're going to use. But samadhi is one of the more confusing terms. Let's see. Actually, going through this article, if you look on the page before, page 18, there's a section header that says sampajana. Apramada and Atapa. Here this author, coming from the Theravada version, says mindfulness includes samprajana. So this is the early tradition that's affiliated with the Satipatthana Sutra. So don't be confused by this. Understand that this is an early way of understanding meditation practice, where in the early tradition, Satipatthana Sutra, the foundations of mindfulness, mindfulness has two uses. It means meditation in general, and it means the factor of attention, focused attention. When it means meditation in general, then it includes samprajna, apramada, and atapa. What happens later in the tradition when we talk about shamatha and vipassana is that we gain some clarity about mindfulness. Mindfulness no longer is used for the general term, so that you don't use it in two places in two different ways. You just use it as the factor of focused attention within the practice of meditation called shamatha. Does that make sense?
What are they, in the questions of my training, what word is used for mindfulness?
I don't think he does. Interestingly enough, we'll go through it. I haven't read it in a while, so I'm rough. He doesn't really define these. Yeah, Neil.
Sorry, I'm repeating the question. Is it sampajana or sampajna?
Let's see, the Pali is sampajanya. So Pali is that row that has two M's with squiggles above them.
Yeah, I'm just comparing the chart with the text.
The author in the text is giving the Pali, but he's spelling it.
You left out an N.
Incorrectly, yeah.
In both places, both in the title of the paragraph and when he talks about it.
Actually, it's more
weird.
Like he's using the Sanskrit.
He uses the Sanskrit for apramada.
Oh, it's mixed, isn't it?
And then he uses the Pali for atapa.
Yeah.
So it's a little rough, this article.
Wikipedia.
It's Wikipedia. I mean,
no, because he's not using the Pali, he's got an R. It's got to be the Sanskrit, right?
Oh yeah, it's actually, yeah, it's kind of looks like he may have just been aiming for the Sanskrit, but he put the squiggle on the wrong end.
Okay.
He might have just mixed it up, yeah.
Or he's...
You're right, it does look like he's more aiming for the Sanskrit.
And then he just missed out the R after the J.
Yeah. It's a little rough. It's an interesting article because it goes through a lot of stuff, but it's not 100% reliable. Let's look at, sorry. But let's, in this vein, let's look at page 6. So here we have a little excerpt from really a text by Longchenpa called Immaculate Light that is apparently his final testament. If you remember, maybe you're not aware, but in the Dzogchen tradition, the early masters of the Dzogchen tradition leave what they call their final testaments to their head disciple. And they're famous for dying and then coming back and giving that final testament from beyond the grave. Just appearing out of space, the hand comes down and, oh, you left us. And then around it, we have a little commentary by Nyosho Kenpo. So the lead-in section and then the little paragraph at the end is by him. But the three paragraphs in the middle, verses rather, are by Longchenpa. So let's look at those verses. Mindfulness, moreover, is like a virtuous hook that catches the crazed rampant elephant of the mind, leading it away from all faults and toward what is virtuous. Rely on this from now on. Mindfulness, the most important aspect. Attentiveness is like an undistracted watchman who affords the thief of non-virtue no opportunity. So, Sampajanya, the watchman, the sheriff, and protects the supreme wealth of virtue. Let your mind rely on it with certainty from now on. So much about virtue.
Sounds like the Shantideva.
Yeah, it's very much like Shantideva, right? Where mindfulness and introspection are about virtue, all about virtue. We now get this tradition from Jon Kabat-Zinn, as made famous, and others, where mindfulness is non-judgmental, non-critical, has no ethical slam to it. That is not the original version of mindfulness and introspection. The original version of mindfulness and introspection has a very heavy ethical slant to it, of virtuousness. Thirdly, conscientiousness. So this is the third quality, bhakkyu. Conscientiousness is like a well-constructed moat which prevents brigand bands of afflictive emotions from striking. It leads an army to victory over the foes of karma. Strive to guard your mind from now on. We must keep the virtuous practices of love, compassion, rejoicing, and so forth, the four immeasurables, in our minds. Mindfulness is like a hook that can subdue the wild elephant of mind. Attentiveness is like a guard who protects the wealth of our virtuous practice, so we should never separate from them. In essence, we must always practice with mindfulness, attentiveness, and conscientiousness. He focuses on those three qualities. On the cover, if you go to the bottom of the cover, I have a couple of verses from Shantideva that relate to this. All you who would protect your minds, maintain your mindfulness and introspection, guard them both at cost of life and limb, I join my hands beseeching you. So that's verse... Oh, I didn't give the... Oh, they're both in chapter 5. Verse 3. Examining again and yet again the state and actions of your body and mind, this alone defines in brief the maintenance of watchful introspection. So what is Sampajanya? Sampajanya is traditionally defined right here, examining again and yet again the state and actions of your body and mind.
So it's not the passion of you're sort of dispassionately analyzing, it's more looking at your karma and analyzing, really focusing on the apparent one.
It's not heavily conceptual. It's not discursive. But it's
just seeing if it's good or bad, I guess.
It understands the sort of resultant feeling tone of experience that coming from the past, relating to, you know, what were past experiences, and how do I understand what's happening now from that framework as being positive or negative.
It's like there's karma in there.
Yes, we're understanding of karma. Let's see. So we go to this article on page 7. This is an interview with a gentleman named John Donne, really wonderful scholar, currently alive on this planet. And talking about mindfulness and like different aspects. So at the very last sentence, he says, you probably know the term. So smriti, sati, mindfulness, tracks back to the Pali word sati. And the term mindfulness tracks back to that word. The Sanskrit word smriti, which is the Tibetan word trenpa. That word itself is used in many different ways. We think of the term sati, there's actually quite a lot of variety. A gentleman named Rupert Getlin has written a number of really great pieces in which he talks about the term. Also Bhikkhu Bodhi has done a lot of work on it. And Analayo is another one that's done some great work on this, on the use of the term in the context of the Pali Canon and the Theravada practice. If you're interested in this, you just Google these guys in mindfulness, and there's some really great articles that they've been producing over the last 20 years or so. And a famous text called The Questions of King Melinda, which is a really great Theravadan compendium, basically. The term is used very much just in the sense of memory. The traditional way that it's used in English, mindfulness is like to keep in mind, be mindful of your hat, be mindful of your head as you go under the doorway. Mindful of, remember, you know, be mindful that it's Mother's Day or my birthday.
Is recollection the same or different?
The same. How do you recall what is beneficial? Recalling what one has done in the past and what one intends to do in the future. So these three words literally mean memory. Memory connected to the sense of who you are as a practitioner, what your larger goals are, and the meaning of mindfulness is something that's become a little bit lost in the contemporary context where mindfulness is used in a different way. When we talk about it as mindfulness practice, that sense of mindfulness, that sense of mindfulness of memory is not the main meaning. The main meaning is cultivating a particular kind of mental facet, any mental moment, or according to some Abhidharma theorists, it's always a facet of every mental moment. It's one of the omnipresent mental factors. So every moment of cognition has a little pinch of mindfulness in it. Really the facet of mind that keeps the mind from wandering. It's actually what keeps the mind not in a positive sense on an object, but in a negative sense off other objects. There are other mental factors that keep the mind focused, that account for how acute the mind is, how sharp the focus is, but this particular facet is really just about a kind of stability. Let's see, maybe skipping this. There are two other important features, the next paragraph, of this factor that are really critically important and that develop later on, that really are more about the Mahayana version of mindfulness. They are there in the earlier materials, but they are much more emphasized in the Mahayana, and they change their meanings a little bit. One of them in Sanskrit is sampajanya. Is called shijin. And this is a kind of capacity to keep track of the state of mind and body, depending on the theorist you talk to. that either is something that occurs simultaneously while you're on the object, or it requires you to drop the object momentarily and sort of introspect on the moment. And that will be important for another reason in a second. So in one case, you're focused on the object with mindfulness, and you're exerting introspection that's sort of surrounding the object, sort of looking at and you looking at the object and seeing whether you're on it or not. And the alternative that he mentions is that sometimes it just looks at you in your state of practice, and it drops the you drop the focus on the breath, and you just have this sense of looking at, watching yourself meditate. Basically, if you're trying to maintain awareness on the breath, mindfulness is what keeps the mind from wavering off that object, but you also need to assess the quality of your awareness as you're watching your breath. Because as you get more and more advanced, you're not just dropping the object entirely, you're actually able to still stay on the object and notice before you lose the object when the mind is becoming unstable in some fashion. The faculty that is doing that, that is sort of monitoring the quality of mind, is called Samprajnana or Shejin. That is actually so integral to mindfulness practice that the Tibetans usually compound Drenpa and Shejin to make Drenche, which means mindfulness, and some people translate that as discriminating awareness. This is what Trungpa Rinpoche did in his seminary teachings. He talked about mindfulness and awareness, and then he brought them together. He said, talk about Drenche. What is interesting about Shejin is it then has a little bit of life of its own. It's something Shantideva talks about a great deal. He has an entire chapter devoted to the fifth chapter, which I just quoted from Bodhicharyavatara. It becomes in some ways almost more what we think of as mindfulness practice, which is kind of a moment-by-moment awareness of what you're doing. Where's your mind? Where's your body? What are your intentions? Are you in a virtuous mind state or in a negative mind state? That is really all the work that is done by Shejin or Samprajnana, a sort of monitoring capacity or discriminative awareness. Along with that, then, a third quality is usually mentioned in the Tibetan text, which is called Pak Yu. Now, in Tibetan, G and K are somewhat interchangeable. So earlier we saw B-A-K-Y-O, now we see B-A-G-Y-O. And you see this in Dzogchen, where sometimes it's spelled with a G and sometimes a K, right? So here we have the same term, Pak Yu, and it's monosyllabic language. So you say Bak, B-A-G, Yu. You don't say Bagyo. Pak Yu. Or Apramada. That basically means heedfulness. Okay, now he just equated Pakya and Apramada. And if we look at our chart, yeah, that's the chart now. Okay. That basically means heedfulness. Heedfulness. Different than introspection, different than mindfulness.
Very moral, too.
Very moral.
I mean, in terms of like,
you could be a criminal and be heedful, you know, don't leave any trace.
With like an English,
sure, they mean
to be heedful would be to be directed. Like, I'm paying heed, I'm heedful of this. It's like in a form of exertion to be heedful of
it
something.
It does have an energy.
Yeah,
it definitely has
without,
an energetic quality.
Without energy, you're not heedful.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So to be heedful is to have exertion towards some kind of intent.
Yeah.
Whatever the aspiration is. So
yeah.
I'm just trying to make sense of English language that is being pointed to by some of these words.
Yeah. Well, heed is not a common word these days, right? I mean, you know, it's sort of, you say pay heed, and you know, it's like, oh, we're talking now, we're going back to our English Catholic roots or something. But it definitely has an energetic quality, which, you know, sort of brings it together with ardency. It seems like these two qualities have some relationship.
Carefulness.
That's what Rinpoche called the carefulness.
Carefulness.
Yeah. Walking on eggshells. three together, Trenpa, he's using the Tibetan. Trenpa, mindfulness, Sheshen, introspection, and Bakyu, conscientiousness, heedfulness, really give you the package. Then he says of mindfulness. He should have said, really give you the package of meditation or shamatha in the Tibetan context. Alright? Those three are create shamatha meditation. Those three are the three aspects of shamatha meditation. The kind of practice we're talking about is stability, but also this kind of stability with awareness, not just the dumb focus on an object. So when we talk about meditation, we're talking about we're not in an absorption state that blocks out everything else. Like dhyana is an absorption state. It's a focused inward that does block out everything else. It doesn't have samprajanya, specifically. It does not have samprajanya, absorption. But a rich awareness of what is happening to you on the subject side, happening to you as the subject of a meditative, of a cognitive experience. What emotional states are happening? What is the quality of the awareness? What are you holding too tightly into? Are you holding too tightly into the object? Or are you so loose, are you about to lose it? Are negative emotions beginning to rise? Or are you in a positive emotional state? This capacity to sort of monitor those sort of things, even while remaining on the object, is really the main thing that's cultivated in shamatha practice. Then the larger context of it is your spiritual goals, and that is where heedfulness comes in. To be heedful of what your values are, what your goals are, what your motivations are, all of that. Which is almost like understanding our view in meditation. Being heedful of what is our view, what is our understanding of the practice of meditation, all of it.
So heedful is like being steadfast.
Yes, as the three of them together is steadfastness, stability.
Good medieval words.
Stability. And stability doesn't mean like a limited, you know, focused state that blocks everything out, but a stability is able to be stable because it's watching what's going on. It's almost like it has this concentric circle quality, where in the inside is the focused attention, and then you have a watchfulness around that, and then around that a heedfulness. Neil?
It's within context, so you're applying your mindfulness or results of that into some predetermined view.
I think so. You're being heedful of what's going on. Cynthia?
This brings up an interesting thing that came up when in August, I taught the Meditation Everyday Life course.
Yeah.
And maybe the second or third week, one of the young man who was in the class asked, maybe simply, what is meditation? And so as we were reading through this, it kind of reminded me of the interesting question that raises, because as I, you know, kind of attempted to give a response to that, and then I also did a little bit of research following up. And in a way, some of this is touching on the same thing, that if you try to define meditation, as soon as you go beyond a few basic words, you get into the question of context of view. Sorry, I was writing what you were saying, because you know, you can say basically it's a kind of training of the mind, and that's, I think, fairly universally through, I don't know. But as soon as you go beyond that and say to do something, you're already getting into a view and a context that may differ depending on what tradition you're in. And I looked up, I did a little bit of research after that weekend and, you know, checked out many sources and it really many places came back to that same point, which is that you really cannot define meditation, and in this case we're talking using the word mindfulness, as you said, kind of instead of that. You can't do it without immediately jumping into views.
Well, to be heedful, you gotta know what to be heedful of.
Well, I mean, in some cases, it's just for the sake of being heedful. You know, you can have very secular purposes for meditation, where you're just, you know, and I think that's what he's kind of slightly touching on here, but I found that the more I looked into this question of what is it, many people, very often, I found that lots of interesting stuff in Lion's Roar, and almost everywhere I looked, found that same point being made, that as soon as you go beyond those first few, you know, the first basic statement, you're immediately going into to reach enlightenment, to whether it's for a more applied purpose or whether it's more for an enlightenment kind of purpose, very different.
Yeah.
And yet they're all called meditation. And in meditation, they're all called amazing how such a simple question is actually quite profound and deep.
I don't even think you can say it's mind training, because actually everything is mind training.
Well, in a sense that's true, but on the other hand, think of it as an exercise. Come up with what is an honest definition. We all think we know what it is because we've done it, or we think we have. But to actually define it is not an easy thing to do. So as I sampled through the different things, most of them kind of touched on it in the way of, I didn't like it first thinking of it as mind training, because of course then I think, all sorts of more advanced mind training. But anyway, it's just something to contemplate. What is it, this thing that you did?
No idea. So then on the next page, page 10, the other thing though that really becomes important in Tibetan meditation is the development of these qualities in the Mahamudra context. What is different and what is really significantly different from the non-Mahayana versions of mindfulness is now that there is a notion of being mindful without being focused on an object.
Mm-hmm.
You'll see this in the Galupa version of Mahamudra, but it's perhaps more strongly stressed by the Kagyu style of Mahamudra. And then you see similar aspects to Dzogchen. This is the notion that one can retain that kind of awareness, an awareness of what is the state of mind, what is the quality of one's awareness, what types of mental states are occurring, what is the quality of consciousness itself, by taking that monitoring faculty, shesham, and in a sense ramping it up and no longer focusing on any object, dropping the object entirely, so that now what you have left is that monitoring awareness itself. You're still going to latch onto objects now and then, so it's not truly a non-dual awareness, but it is moving toward a non-dual awareness because it's no longer sort of thematizing a focus on the objects such as the breath. Alan Wallace has a nice way of describing this, where it is as if the breath becomes kind of like a buoy out of the water that you keep your hand off, and then you sort of let go and slowly learn how to not need to hold on to that anymore, and are simply aware of the mind itself without focusing on any particular object. That capacity is the way, theoretically, where Shesham, Samprajnana, this sort of discriminating alertness, is now what is mostly thematized in Mahamudra practice, in meditation practice. Our stability is still important, and they still talk about smriti or drenpa, mindfulness, but now it's drenpa without an object. This type of meditation practice is what's mostly talked about these days. Instead, what they speak about is what's called in Tibetan, and you will see this in the famous Mahamudra text, blah, 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 and also in other Kagyu Mahamudra materials, is, and he gives this Tibetan term, which means mindfulness of mirror, not distraction. Instead of being...
Did you say that again? Mindfulness?
...of mirror, not distraction. So when we talk about mindfulness of the breath, we say we have mindfulness of the breath. The breath is the object, and we're mindful of that. Here, not distraction is the object. So not distraction is a mind that's just sort of contained within itself, is present, currently knowing, is aware.
Non-implicative negation.
It's sort of like a non-implicative negation, right? And that's what you're mindful of. You're mindful of just being presently there. So as we do the practice, going from a beginner where we're struggling to focus on the breath, to find the breath, to focus on the breath, to come back to the breath. And we have this sense of bringing ourselves back to the breath. Gradually, we're able to stay with the breath, and then we don't need that buoy anymore. We're here. We don't need to continually focus on the breath. We just focus on being here. We have that same attention on mere non-distraction. So being here without being caught up in thought, just not being distracted. You know,
there is a distinction to be made there between you're just substituting one object for another.
Basically, you are. You're focused. The mind needs some object. So, what would the object be?
Does it? Does the mind need some object?
It does.
Ah.
There's a mind.
That's an interesting.
So, what would the object be?
Thought.
Yeah. Well, dualistic mind, by definition, has an object. Non-dualistic mind has no object.
But isn't that, to some extent, that unification?
The problem with that is that non-dualistic mind only occurs at enlightenment, path of seeing.
Is it still called mind at that point?
And then calling it mind is a little
deeper. Is this a distinction between consciousness?
But really, the object is mind.
The object is mind.
When we say attention, mindfulness of mere non-distraction, it's mindfulness of the mind, not distracted. It's mind is the object.
And do you get beyond that point?
Yes, you do get beyond that.
Which is not the same as just blanking out and thinking.
Right. So mindfulness of mind is very different than blanking out. And that becomes a big issue in the Mahamudra tradition, where other schools criticize the Mahamudra practitioners as blanking out.
That's very hard to distinguish, I think.
It could be hard to distinguish.
Well,
but it's like a world of difference at the same time.
Yeah. When you talk about clarity or absence of clarity.
Okay. That's
just forgetting the instructions. That's just going back to, if you're blanking out, that's just all that happened there.
Well, it's different than forgetting the instructions and getting lost in thought. It's like getting lost in a vacuous mental state where the mind is like is so weak and it becomes diffuse. It's like you lose the energy of thought patterns and the mind just like sort of sinks down into this mud area, right?
It doesn't feel like that.
Well, that... You haven't reached true vacuum. Just wait.
You said it doesn't feel that bad?
It doesn't feel like that. But it doesn't feel like you're sinking into the body.
Oh.
Trungpa, Black Ashe, describes the tiger. He says the tiger is the warrior which has their mind never stolen away from him. And so, to me, that's always been pointing to the sort of description of that sort of subtle dynamic play of never latching on to anything while one just sits.
That mindfulness of mere non-distraction is now not about focusing on any particular object, but simply being aware moment by moment of all that's occurring in the mind. That type of awareness, of course, is part of the goal, part of the reason you cultivate that type of awareness is so that you really understand what is the nature of your mind, because that really is the object there. What is the nature of your negative mental states and so forth, and it's a tool for that purpose. So with that perspective, let's then go back to the chart on page 5 and go through the remaining few of the 6 powers. And we'll see that there's a progression where the next power is mindfulness. It doesn't mean that the other factors that we just talked about are not present at all, but they're not nearly as strong as mindfulness. As we go through the stages of learning how to practice shamatha, we then experience focused attention mindfulness, and that's the predominant experience. And without going through that focused attention period of focus, of being able to focus, you can't proceed onward genuinely. You'll be fooling yourself unless you're actually able to have focused attention on an object. And then once you're able to do that consistently, to with some consistency, then you develop the next power, which is introspection. Right? That next mental faculty, that next faculty of shamatha, introspection. And while that was present to a limited extent with the mindfulness, it now becomes much more pronounced, and you shift from constantly being preoccupied with the object to then resting in the watchfulness and continuing to not drift away without having a strong fixation on the object, but more emphasis on the watchfulness. Rinpoche calls this shifting your allegiance from like being in content of thought to being in the watcher. And then the next power is exertion, that heedfulness quality, that quality of energetic presence, that where the sort of watchfulness, the sort of dualistic sense of watchfulness gets refined. And it's just this quality of energetically being present and being there.
Is there a mental sort of angle on exertion? Like one of the definitions that sort of... Because exertion sounds very physical.
Well, it's mental exertion.
It's mental exertion.
So what happens is, what's described here is that as you go from mindfulness, where there's mental exertion, you're exerting yourself to be mindful, to be focused attention. And then you begin to realize that you can be watchful. You don't have to exert as much attention. It's not as strenuous. So then you relax into the watchfulness. And then your sense of space, spaciousness, panoramic awareness expands. You expand outward, as Rinpoche describes endlessly, that panoramic awareness. But what happens is that it then becomes fuzzy and weak. You expand and relax too much. So there's a lull. You sort of begin to enjoy not having a barrage of thoughts all the time. It's really a great experience, right? It's refreshing to not have that barrage of thought. And you sort of dwell in that. And so you need to then rouse this energy to electrify the experience. I think of it as like turning on the light. It's like you've relaxed into the darkness of a room. But now you're going to turn on the light. Come back to vividness. So,
if you're not careful, then you become mindful of one thing, and then that steals your mind away. So it's this subtle balance between not too much exertion and not too little relaxation.
Right, which is the next power, right? So initially one exerts too much, and then one has to then counter that. So there's a process of abusing the powers in a positive sense initially, and then countering their sort of fault, their sort of downside. Mindfulness initially is essential, but then it has too much strenuousness, too much limitation. So you need to counter that with the openness, the expansiveness of the watchfulness. And then the watchfulness, its downside is it becomes limpid and weak and lazy. So you need to counter that with energy, exerting yourself again. And then that can become overly strenuous again, too tense. And so you counter that with equanimity, where all the different factors then come together and are operating together at the same time in equilibrium, in a balanced way, so that you're not falling to one side or another, and everything's working. And then you have that sense of pliancy, suppleness or synchronized body and mind, where you're able to do what you want to do with your mind and body. You're able to be present for as long as you want in meditation. And the descriptions of the achievement of shamatha are very, very advanced compared to what we think about. It's like being able to sit in meditation for 4 hours without moving. Just you say, I'm going to do this, and then you do that. You are aware through the night, through sleep, including deep sleep. So, in case you're wondering, you know, where you are. I'm sorry.
In New York, you usually are aware through the night.
There's the garbage. Yeah. Okay, so... shamatha now is presented, and that is, you know, the very much the culmination of years and years of different streams and teachings and practitioners going through their experiences that come down. It was the obstacles and antidotes and the stages were put forward by Maitreya Sangha back in the 3rd, 4th century. So they had that scheme. Basically, at the same time the Sambhita Motion Sutra comes out, they're talking about that scheme. The 9 stages, the obstacles, the antidotes, the powers in their text as well. And so then that comes down to us over time. It gets fleshed out and gets understood more clearly into what John Donne went through and what I tried to explain through those things. So thank you very much. Have a good evening. See you soon. By this merit,
may all attain omniscience. May it defeat the enemy of wrongdoing. From the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may I free all beings.
By the confidence of the golden son of the great beast, may the lotus garden of the victims wisdom bloom.
May the dark ignorance of sentient beings be dispelled.
May all beings enjoy profound, brilliant glory.
Thank you.